Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Oh god, I can't believe I watched Greenland and I could have like watched this twice.
I think this is an incredibly moving film, and Duval, like when he's reading Moby Dick to the chap that's gone blind, I think that scene is incredible, and Duval is just doing so much by just trying to be as good as possible, and like that can just be the most heartbreaking thing.
But he sells that moment so well, and it's so understated but authentic and true to his experience. It's very, very moving. And you know, just to go back to slating Michael Bay for a second, so much more moving than having the power ballad moment.
Hey everybody, welcome to this episode of Flix Watcher Podcast. Today I'm joined by Jake.
Hello.
Michael.
Hello.
Helen.
Hello.
And we are going deep, impacting.
Thank you as always to the mighty people for the mighty, mighty tunes. And thanks to Ben from Rockwood Audio for his awesome editing skills.
Please do remember to write a review and rate us on Apple Podcasts, anywhere you can do where you listen to the podcast, because it really does help us.
And you can join in the conversation with us on Twitter
at FlixWatcherPod and on Instagram
at FlixWatcher. Hello, film fans. Thanks for joining us today. Remotely, we have Jake and Michael with us. If you could please say hello and tell the listeners a little bit more about who you are and what you do, please.
Yes, so I'm Michael Leader, and my beautiful assistant is Jake Cunningham. Although assistant, I mean Jake, that's overselling your contribution to the projects we do together. We are both the hosts of Ghibli Attack, podcast all about the films of Studio Ghibli, where I do all the work and Jake's along for the ride. Is that right, Jake?
Is that because you know about, well, beforehand you knew about Studio Ghibli and Jake knew nothing?
Well, I mean, yes, of course.
I mean, he'd seen Spirited Away, but I mean, that's
basically... He'd watched half of Spirited Away on his phone, I think, is your origin story, isn't it, Jake? And I'm sorry, it's all coming out now. I'm embarrassing you in front of all these listeners here. But yes, way back when, we've worked together for a few years, and across the desk in the office one day, I was wanging on about Studio Ghibli. I'm a huge fan of theirs, been watching their films for years. And it came up that Jake hadn't watched at least many of the films. And we started a whole conversation, and a colleague said, this should be a podcast. And a podcast was born.
And when we have people from other podcasts that are based on film, they rarely ever bring their homework, their chosen subject into discussion here. Netflix has got all the Studio Ghibli films apart from like one or two. Mm-hmm. Why didn't you pick a Studio Ghibli film?
Busman's Holiday, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Fine. That's fine.
Seen them all now, isn't he?
Yeah, but we're trying to get people... These guys have got a book to sell. And sorry, tell us about your book.
Well, yeah, Michael said that he does all the work and I don't really do anything. I mean, I did write at least 50% of a book about Studio Ghibli. So I think since that intervening years of not having seen any of them to actually watching them and watching them enough times to write a book about them, I think I've kind of gone a little bit from maybe like... nursery up to at least maybe the end of secondary school level of Ghibli knowledge.
Do you not think you can submit it as a PhD thesis?
Oh God, no. I couldn't deal with that. I mean,
you don't want that scrutiny.
Writing this was hard enough. I don't know if I've got any more words to go about Studio Ghibli.
When's the book coming out, guys? So you guys, as we release this episode, it's coming out 2nd of September, is it?
Mm-hmm. 2nd of September, yeah. Out in the UK then, and it's out in the US a couple of weeks later. And in other territories, there's translations out in Russian, Korean, French,
What's that like?
Spanish. Very strange, because the title of the podcast is a pun, so it's trying to see these other languages try and force this pun into the language. It's quite fun.
How do you pick which languages you choose?
We didn't. So this is our publisher kind of arranged all these deals. And it's quite entertaining to see these just popping up around the world.
Yeah, so with the Spanish edition, so Ghibliotheque is spelt like bibliotheque, so T-H-E-Q-U-E at the end, so a bit of a French pun. But for the Spanish edition, they just changed it to Ghibliotheca. So literally, you're going for biblioteca in Spanish. Mm-hmm. So it would be amazing to see how that works out in languages where it's not tech or teca.
But biblioteca works in most European languages. Biblioteca is, or teca of that kind of form, is library, isn't it? So for Europe, it tends to kind of scan, doesn't it?
Yeah, so yeah. Russian's I'm looking for
the Cyrillic one will be very good.
Cyrillic, the Greek. Thai. Yeah, man. Awesome. Well, Jake's been on there before. You know the rules. You've got 60 seconds to tell us about the film you've chosen. And the film you've chosen is Deep Impact. Can you tell us why you chose it, first of all? And then I'll get the timer up and then you'll have 60 seconds to give the synopsis.
Yep. I picked Deep Impact because it's possibly the last great blockbuster of the 20th century.
Okay.
And is unfairly maligned and sits in the shadow of Armageddon for no reason and is perhaps a perfect film. So Deep Impact follows an ensemble cast as they deal with an asteroid that's colliding or on a collision course with Earth. You've got Elijah Wood, who is a youthful astronomer who discovers this asteroid. You've got Morgan Freeman as the president, who has to deal with the logistics of facing this asteroid. You've got Robert Duvall and the crew of a spaceship who are tasked with going to the asteroid to try and blow it up. And you've got Tia Leone as a reporter who has been covering the story of the asteroid heading to Earth from its discovery to its ultimate deep impact. And along the way, thanks, mate. and along the way, there are trials, there are tribulations, there is a substantial amount of failure, which I absolutely love. And there's a fantastic story by James Horner.
So you set your stall out by saying it's a perfect film, the best film, best blockbuster of the pre-noughties. Well, there you go, there's your timer. Michael, what are your initial thoughts on Deep Impact?
I mean, that's quite a claim to make, Jake. I think the year 1999, for many people, one of the best years for Hollywood cinema, would have something to say about you
Phantom
saying.
Phantom Menace.
Yeah, this comes in under the wire. Everyone else had an extra year. This one did it 1 year early.
I do know what you mean, Jake. This is the sort of film we don't really get anymore, told at a scale with an ensemble cast, with an intelligence and an emotional intelligence that we don't really get to see much. So I can understand that. I think it does have flaws the size of Manhattan,
which is luckily the same size as a meteor that's coming towards towards Earth.
But we don't need to look at those flaws, you know. Who cares whether the Russian astronaut has any family at home that we need to speak to, as well as all of the Americans? It doesn't matter. The rest of the film is superb.
Helen, where do you lie on Deep Impact?
So, apart from it having three ER members in, which is always a great, great moment for any film for me to see, I really love it. And it is, it was so overshadowed by Armageddon, and people treated it so unfairly that revisiting again, it's just got something about it. And I love that there's a lot of failure in it. And I also kind of love the whole thing, like, and other countries are going to do similar things, sort of like, you know, this is just going to happen here, and the other countries will have their other caves. And
well, Mimi Leader wanted to show those other countries, but they just didn't have the budget to do it.
That's a cop-out excuse, right? I like to think, rewatching this last night, that somewhere, I mean, America gets Morgan Freeman as the most perfect president, and somewhere there's probably Rick Mayall as Boris Johnson alike saying, maybe we could just let the comet come and take it on the chin. That's the British approach to Deep Impact. So it's probably a good thing we didn't see that.
I think so.
But I think the sort of the importance placed on floppy disks is greatly overrated. Who knew, hey, that they weren't going to be that important in the future? And classic 90s internet on screen is always a delight to see for me. So it just didn't have a song, did it? Maybe that was it. Maybe that's what it was missing.
Well, let's talk about, obviously, whenever you talk about Deep Impact, you think Armageddon and vice versa. Where are we in the Deep Impact versus, should we do a quick straw poll, Deep Impact versus Armageddon, assuming we've seen them both? So, Helen, you're saying Deep Impact over Armageddon?
I think so, but I do like Armageddon for completely different reasons, mostly because it's completely ridiculous and I like the song.
Jake?
Oh, Deep Impact for sure. Just to point out, there were, you know, the Criterion Collection, like the kind of absolute highest bar of cinephile of libraries. They entered two Michael Bay films into the Criterion Collection, one of which was Armageddon, before they entered a film with a female director.
Oh, really? That's you know, you taught high bar and then it was a rug pull then, wasn't it? Michael?
I'll place Deep Impact ahead of Armageddon. Again, as Helen said, they're ticking very different boxes, although they do have some sequences that are very similar, particularly family members watching their other family members blow themselves up on a comet and their hand being on a TV of static. But the way that Deep Impact really wants to go for a different sort of more serious emotion rather than the melodramatic, bombastic emotion of, you know, Steven Tyler wailing away in the background of Armageddon.
Yeah, I think it's a clean sweep. I've only seen each of them once beforehand. This is my second time watching Deep Impact. I'm not really interested in watching Armageddon again because I remember it just being a bit stupid, generally. And it is. This is...
Whereas Deep Impact is like a documentary.
Yeah, this is exactly as it would happen. They've consulted all of NASA's like scientists to work out what they would do with an asteroid. I just like it a bit more. I like the actors more compared to Armageddon, although Bruce Willis is always be one of the greatest, but also at the same time is a bit of a tit sometimes. But here you've got Robert Duvall, Morgan Freeman usurps anyone on there. I love an early Jon Favreau, which is hilarious. Mary McCormack, who's from the West Wing, first time seeing her outside of the West Wing. Elijah Wood, probably the first time I saw him. And Tia Leone, which in this, I thought she was perhaps the worst thing in it, to be honest with you.
Yeah, so this is something I'm keen to ask the room on, because I think she is the not just the weak link, the weakest link. And she has a pretty hard role to play. So Jake, I'm sure I beat you to it, to use the word Spielbergian here. So having a main character whose like, sort of hope and dreams before the world ends is to get her parents back together or to build bridges with you know, as a child of divorce, that's a very Spielbergian sort of character trait. And Tia Leone has to have that turn of being the cynical wannabe TV anchor, but then go on that journey where we have to really start to feel for her and her pain by the end. And I just find that there was a point in the mid-late 90s where I think Tia Leone and David Duchovny were in a couple, weren't they? And it was just the least emotive couple in showbiz land. And I don't think she really stands up. If it was someone like, I don't know, if it was 10 years before and it was Holly Hunter, if it was maybe 10 years later, and I don't know who else would play that role really well. Rachel McAdams, I don't know.
Throw Greta in there.
Oh, wow, yeah. I can think of so many other actors that would have worked well, but maybe circa 1998, there wasn't just the right one.
It's kind of, because it's interesting when certain actors and actresses have their moments in the sun and they're everywhere for a bit and then they kind of fade away. And Tia Leone had Bad Boys. She had, I think she's in quite a few other things at the time. So her son was generally on the ascendance, but then it has faded. And when I look at this, I'm thinking, well, I can see why.
I think like the role is, it purposely is quite a cold role, because I think this is Mimi Leader tackling something that she's obviously interested in when you get to a film like On the Basis of Sex, where it's like the female role in the workplace and the way that you have to kind of remove emotion to approach kind of graduating through the like patriarchal structure of something like a news network. And Tia Leone, I think, can handle that side of it. But as you say, Michael, when it gets to the back end of it and she needs to sell that hugging your father and saying a wistful daddy in the face of a giant tidal wave, that's the element she can't sell. But I think she can sell the newsroom stuff.
I wasn't even sure about newsroom stuff, but I don't know, Helen, are we spending too much time on Tia Leone when there's other people to talk about?
No, I mean, it's a fairly meaty role. I mean, there's probably a reason why we're not still talking about her now, is that she just isn't that great.
I mean, we can jump to some other performances. I mean, there are so many good ones.
I love Laura Innes, and I think she's great in this. Even just like the bits she's on screen when she's next to Tia Leone, she's just different. And it's that kind of thing where you're just like, yeah, there is a reason why, you know, some people are around and then suddenly they're not. But yeah, it's always fun watching Elijah Wood's earlier outings when he's so wide-eyed and young and fresh-faced, and later on he's still so wide-eyed and fresh-faced. But yeah, I think for me it's Morgan Freeman as the president, and there's the bit of trivia how he wanted like to have a pierced ear or something to show that he was kind of like a regular man, which was kind of like, no, we're not going to do that. But like there's a scene where he's got like tattoos to show he's kind of like a regular dude, and I kind of like those little bits about it. But yeah, for me, I think it is, you just trust him as your president, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
I think there are like, there's little details in his performance, which like, so this is the second time that I've watched the film in lockdown, and I really love it, and I get something out of it each time. And this time, noticing little things that Freeman's doing, like when he's got to do the press conference where he reveals to the world what's about to happen, as he's stepping up to the plate and the studio director or the press room director says 10 seconds, Freeman just kind of looks up at him, gives him a little smile and a nod, and just thanks him just for that little role of directing him to the podium. And it's like a blink and you miss it thing. But like when you watch the rest of the performance, it's full of little things like that, that like this kind of humanity that he's bringing to it. Because like there's so many presidential roles and presidential roles that Freeman himself has played where there is nothing to the character beyond being the president. But you actually get a sense of this man beyond the role that he has to play.
Elijah Wood's character, who gets a comet named after him in part, what do you make of that kind of storyline with his sweetheart piece?
Oh, it's lovely, isn't
piece.
It?
Lovely, right? It's so that's probably, if I could, I don't know. So there are basically three main plot threads, right? There's Taylor Leone and the president. There's what's happening in DC. There's what's happening in space with Bob Duvall, John Favreau, etc. And then there's what's happening in suburban Americana with Elijah Wood and co. And I almost feel like that could have been a standalone movie if Steven Spielberg was making this, or if J.J. Abrams was ripping off Steven Spielberg and making something like Super 8. It would be really cool to have one of those suburban kids on choppers riding around, tooling around at night, latchkey kids. That rise to infamy of having the comet that's going to destroy the Earth named after you. They could have done so much with that if they wanted to. But yeah, you say, Kobe, about the fact that we've not chosen a Studio Ghibli film. My favourite Studio Ghibli film, Whisper of the Heart, is a sort of teen romance where at the end they were searching for some way to end this romance on a high, and they just the two characters declare their love for each other and say, one day we're going to get married, and just suddenly out of nowhere takes on this dimension. And I guess, yeah, kids can do that. Maybe if a comet was coming to Earth and you wanted to save your loved one, you will just randomly get married. Although my partner, when we were watching it at that point, did suddenly say, even though everything with the comets happening, she kind of says, that's a bit far-fetched.
I mean, that's what I was kind of thinking. I just thought, it's a bit much. Especially
for
me, it was the bit with the motorbike where he screams past them at 128 miles per hour, but she calls back, Elijah Wood. I can't remember what character's name is. And he stops, takes off his helmet, and like, oh, there you are. I've searched for you for literally 2 minutes. Maybe that's just me being unmorkish.
So out of all the story strands, that was the one that had the most left on the cutting room floor. So there is a 3-hour version of Deep Impact that gets us a lot more Leo Biedermann action. But I'm happy with the level that we get. Because I think we're going to
call for the release the Mimi Letta cut or the Elijah Wood cut.
I would love to see it. But actually, maybe I wouldn't, because I think what's great about this film is the pace of it as well. Mm. Like it does it all in 2 hours. And I think if this were to be made now, this would definitely be kind of in your 230, 240 zone.
Loaded, yeah.
Yeah, and it zips through it. And it got me, since the last time I watched the film, it got me thinking of like the way that we kind of just very much adjusted to the way of the world as the kind of pandemic unfolded over the last 18 months. And you look back like, within the space of weeks, how things change so quickly, and how Deep Impact, as it makes these time jumps, like 18 months later and we know about the asteroid, and then 5 months later and there's like detritus on the streets and everyone going under this hole in the ground, and it doesn't do like a massive kind of warp time effect thing transition to get people there. It's very casual, and it made me feel like when we were watching the news and like the way that these massive news events just suddenly became kind of pretty easy to take in because we just became so kind of less sensitive to it. And I thought, like, yeah, this actually kind of feels like if this were to unfold, this is gradually how it would feel, that it would just seem so casual.
I get that. Where are we, guys, on before we head to the scores? Disaster movies in general, what are your thoughts, interests, dislikes?
I would say that probably a reason that I'm quite attached to the film is that when I was very, very young, I had the Big Book of Disasters published by Dorling Kindersley, and I loved it. And I just obsessively read about massive disasters.
Have you been watching Loki?
Yeah, I have been watching Loki. Yeah, people could probably hide in the in Demon.
Sorry, guys, if you haven't been watching Loki, that's really sad. Is this the pinnacle of disaster movies, Helen, Michael?
Helen, what do you think?
Well, I was watching this and then I was thinking, oh, God, I can't believe I watched Greenland and I could have, like, watched this twice in the space of watching that. Yeah, I mean, we're still making them. I don't know whether we're making anything particularly better than this, maybe. Mm-hmm. There was kind of an era, wasn't there, the 70s, which were kind of peak disasters, and then somewhere around the 90s, we started remaking all of those 70s films. I think watching this, I was kind of like thinking, this is sort of a little bit like climate change. We had a warning and kind of, you know, various like half-brained ideas about like blasting the meteor out of space with a rocket. It's like, well, there's kind of a lot of weird climatey change sort of solutions, like blasting rockets into space to explode carbon dioxide and stuff like this. Loads of very, very, very weird ways out of climate change other than like stopping consumption, cars, etc., etc. So there's kind of like some, not maybe if they remade this, but maybe I think there's definitely more of a climate change disaster movie perhaps in the pipelines, which may or may not shift public kind of opinion. Because I think for a while people were a bit like, this Armageddon, are the things in space that are going to come down and wipe us out? Because it feels like there could be from these two films. Yeah, those kind of vibes I got from it.
I might not call this the peak of the genre, Kobe, which is sort of what you asked, but this is the sort of disaster movie I'd like to see more of. It feels that 96 to 98, you had films like Independence Day, Armageddon, and this, and whether it was Mimi Leder, who was kind of looking back to the 1970s, looking back to Spielberg in a sort of emotional undercurrent, philosophical undercurrent of if a comet's going to hit, you know, there's that great speech that Morgan Freeman gives about some of you will really feel like this existential dread because of this. But they went with the Roland Emmerich, Michael Bay approach, and you get Day After Tomorrow, 2012, Greenland, etc. There's only really one sort of disaster-ish movie really that I'd point to that works like this, and that's Contagion. And there's also industry factors, I suppose. This sort of film doesn't exist. It's only $80 million. I know it's quite a lot in 1998 money, but it still is the high end of, or the low end of high budget, or the high end of mid budget that won't exist in a few years after this when the franchises take over. Most of, as Helen pointed out, most of these actors go to telly and you lose a lot of these, well, you don't lose these character actors. They then go and have great multi-season arcs on something like ER, or you get Duck from Mad Men here, who's only in for like a couple of like brief scenes. So, yeah.
Yeah, Mad Men, West Wing, Richard Schiff in this from West Wing.
Absolutely.
You said,
so it feels said, like ER. Not just the end, it's on the cusp of something, a new era of cinema, but also the end of a sort of era of what we came to the movies for as well.
Yeah, I mean, I quite like Greenland, particularly for the fact you follow one family all the way through this thing, and is that kind of the emotional beats and the ups and downs, in the way that the best kind of zombie movies for me are when you see the impact it has on the family or a small group of people rather than the whole world being taken over by zombies. So yeah, I did really take that and see how the world can collapse. So Jake was talking about how people within the space of like 18 months within Deep Impact, you get used to Morgan Freeman appearing on the TV every day and telling us, okay, the meteor's still approaching. But I'm sure the first day it was mayhem when he announced that in places, which is the story that Greenland tells.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the family stuff, Kobe, because I think something that's like kind of going on in the background throughout the film and is never the center of attention is just the kind of role of children in all of this. Like, they are just totally present all the time. Like, within the newsroom, there's a creche. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, like, you've got within a media building a creche for kind of people to bring their kids to work. I mean, that would be progressive now to have that kind of thing in place. And so you've always got these kids ever present. Even Elijah Wood, at the end, he gets given a baby. And that just, so you kind of feel this kind of weight of kind of the next generation throughout the film in everyone's story. And like, it's not like in the Joss Whedon Justice League where you have to cut back to the same family that you don't really know a few times every scene just to remind everyone that there's a threat to the youth. Like, this is just like, it is absolutely baked into almost every moment of it. Like, you feel that threat across so many people.
No, and for me, there are a couple of big cry moments when the Messiah is signing off. But for me, we've not really mentioned Robert Duvall, but he is one of the most engaging actors who can do so much with so little. And it's, you know, you say, Jake, it sells these relationships when he says, you know, I'm coming home to his wife, who is a character died years before the film even starts, narrative wise. But he sells that moment so well, and it's so understated but authentic and true to his experience. It's very, very moving. And, you know, just to go back to slating Michael Bay for a second, so much more moving than having the power ballad moments at the same time.
I think this is an incredibly moving film. And Duvall, like, when he's reading Moby Dick to the chap that's gone blind, I think that scene is incredible. And Duvall is just doing so much by just trying to be as good as possible. And like, that can just be the most heartbreaking thing. And
Duvall's great. We had him recently on Falling Down, where he's the counterpoint to Michael Douglas. And it's one of those things where Michael Douglas' character in that is obviously what everyone remembers, but without the way that Robert Duvall plays Pendergast, it all falls down. Yeah, I didn't mean to go like that. That's ridiculous. the film wouldn't work at all with that counterpoint and the way that Duvall plays it. But I think, guys, it's time to head to the scores, unless you have anything else to say. We'll obviously carry on talking about stuff when we head to the scores anyway.
Hello, folks. I'm Sam.
And I'm Martin.
And every week for the last 5 years, we've got together to talk about the musician Tom Waits.
He's a gravelly voice singer that sounded like he doused his vocal cords in bourbon and set fire to them with a cigarette and wrote such classic songs as Way Down in the Hole, Downtown Train, Jersey Girl.
He's also the gravelly voiced actor from films such as The Ballad of Buster Scruggs and Seven Psychopaths, both of which coincidentally are on Netflix and both of which Kobe and Helen have discussed here on FlixWatcher.
So make sure you check those episodes out. And when you have a little bit of a taste for the magic that is Tom Waits, why not head over to songbysongpodcast.com or search for Song by Song in your podcatcher of choice to listen to a little bit more about Tom Waits.
So welcome to the FlixWatcher scores. All of our scores are out of 5. You may have decimal places if you wish. And we'll start with you, please, Jake, with your recommendability.
Oh, for sure. It's a 5. if you hadn't gathered that from the intro, I love this film. So, I would heartily recommend it.
You last came on for Hard Eight and 20th Century Women, wasn't it? So just as a, if you like Jake's voice and you want to hear more of FlixWatcher, then head to Hard Eight and 20th Century Women for other episodes of his ilk.
Please do. And I recommend both of those films as well.
Michael,
recommendability. I'd give this a 4, only because this is, as we sort of said, there are some threads and some characters within those threads of this film that aren't immediately engaging. I have a feeling that some people I recommend this to may struggle with Tia Leone, but I think they'll be won over by the end if they do stick through it. So I'll say 4 out of 5.
Helen, you can have decimal places, by the way, Michael.
I think Jake and I are purists in terms of not having half stars.
I don't even half star. Michael's a half star. I can't do it.
You know, I never really used to be, but you know, the years have taken its toll on him. So sometimes certain numbers are just what it is. With that, I'm going to give this 4.7. I do highly recommend it, but I may struggle to recommend it to people who maybe are a little bit like 90s films look a bit kind of shoddy. And it, there's a couple of bits in it that maybe aren't that really kind of like punchy or as big on the kind of effects that people want, and some people just might not buy like the emotion over the kind of action. So that's kind of the caveat, that it is kind of an action film, but it's very much more on that's the external, and kind of what we're focusing on is the relationships between people and how they kind of deal with that. So it's kind of like more of a head and heart rather than kind of like balls and rocks exploding.
So Helen, you're saying it's an art house film?
I mean, it could be, yes.
And you were saying somewhere earlier on, Helen, that like the computer graphics, for example, or the obsession with graphics in the 90s kind of makes it shit.
I like that because I find it very sweet that it was a way to put it on screen, but it does take you out of the moment and back into...
Because there's some scenes that like in...
Google searching.
Like Jurassic Park. Jurassic Park and also like Disclosure, where what you see on screen just already, even when watching Jurassic Park at like 12 years old, I thought that's not good. And you've got like dinosaurs which look real, but then on a computer screen...
The sort of thing that if you're in the wrong sort of mood or the wrong, you know, not really on its wavelength, you could just laugh and probably not stop laughing, considering... And this is, I think, the one bad judgment call is when the scientist is driving down after leaving his pizza at the telescope, and he drives off the cliff and just explodes in the most ridiculous over-the-top explosion. If you don't know what's going to come, by that point it could lapse into parody. And if you're not in the right frame of mind and you think that disaster movies are all silly and over the top, so
I'm going to give a straight four here. I think maybe I just don't like disaster movies that much, but I did like this. That's a nice place to start for the rest of these. Jake, repeat viewing score. You said twice already in the last year, so I'm guessing this is going to be quite high.
Yeah, as I said about the like Morgan Freeman stuff, like you pick out little bits from it. I wasn't as aware of the stuff about the children in the background throughout until this rewatch. And I'm a fan of Mimi Leader's work on TV as well. Like she did some incredible stuff with The Leftovers, and I think
that's top of my list to watch. Now it's now available on Now TV, The Leftovers and Sky. So.
You watch The Leftovers and you watch this as a great companion, because I think ultimately she is not interested that much in the impact of the comet. As you said, Helen, like this is an action film that's focused on emotion. When you actually see the shots of the comet in the sky, it's actually quite peaceful. Like it doesn't do fake sound effect. It kind of looks kind of ethereal. It's relatively calm. This is very much about the people. And so like The Leftovers, similarly to how we have like a tiny percentage of the people have to go into the mine and like what might be the repercussions if you only have a small percentage of people survive from a event like this, The Leftovers is about what if 2% of the entire global population just disappeared one day, and what do people do in the face of a very, very, very obvious sign of their mortality and kind of a physical manifestation of death, and then they have to deal with it. And it's brilliant, and it's not about the drama of the event. It's about the kind of events surrounding it and how people have to face it. It's fantastic, and yeah, really great companion to this.
Give us a number on that.
Oh, 5.
Michael.
Okay, rewatchability. We're on, aren't we? So. This is not really a film to immediately put on again at the end as a credits roll. And I think for me that would be a key ingredient to the 5. So I might have to go 4 for this again. It is a film I might not watch it twice during lockdown, Jake. That's pretty heroic, because it does take you on quite an emotional journey by the end. But it is a film where those performances, the best performances, have such fine kind of details to them, and you know, it's the sort of thing where maybe I miss Robert Duvall. I just want a nice little sort of father figure type speech. I want him to put out the audiobook of Moby Dick, and I'd happily listen to that every night for however long that would take. So I'd say 4.
So this is only my second time watching it, which I think is a shame. I would have liked to have gone back at least another go on that. It is 2 hours, so I'm not in an immediate rush, but I would definitely leave less time between the first watch and the second watch. So 3.5.
Yeah, I'm going to go for 2.8 here. I don't think I'll be rushing back to it. I will revisit it again over Armageddon, certainly. But yeah, like I said, I've just not that big a fan of these disaster films. I need to rewatch Contagion. But when that became like top film ever on iTunes as a result of the pandemic, I thought I don't want to be a part of that. But maybe now there's a bit more semblance of normality coming back, that Contagion might be worth a visit.
I think this is quite a good pandemic watch, because when I watched it the last time in the pandemic, I realised that actually a lot of the threat in the film is about a giant second wave.
Great. Small screen score, Jake.
Well, I can't give that a 5, because I wish I could see this at the cinema. It keeps those kind of destructive scenes down to a minimum, but when they come, they are quite amazing, particularly this kind of wide angle shot of all of the skyscrapers in New York getting wiped away. Mm. And so I do wish I had the opportunity to see that on the big screen. I think James Horner's score is amazing as well, which I would have heard, love to have heard that kind of twinkly piano sound nice and loud. So I'll give it a 3.
Michael?
Yes, I'd give that a 3 as well. Fortunately, it wasn't the right age to have seen this on the big screen. And there, you know, as Jake said, the CG sequences of destruction are the sort of thing that I would like to have seen big, but also are only quite short. But what I would like to see washing over me on the big screen is some of those performances. You have between Duvall and Morgan Freeman, they are actors who. They know how to work the camera. They can do so much with these little details, and seeing that on the biggest screen possible would be fantastic. And yeah, watching this at home on the telly, I really need to upgrade at some point or get some speakers for.
You just upgraded your house.
I know, yeah. So that's going to be even further in the future now. I'm not going to have any of that money soon. So James Horner has, I think, two big themes in this. There's the one which is a bit more brassy theme. There's one which is a really beautiful little tinkly piano motif that is really beautiful, but when you're watching it on your sort of slightly past its sell-by-date telly in the living room, it gets lost a bit. So, yeah, 3.
Helen?
I've never seen it at the cinema. I think our cinema was, like, closed for a year or so when this came out, so there was no cinema watching for these years. And I've only ever seen it on kind of TV size. I don't know whether, if it was on at the Prince Charles and I walked past, would I go in? Maybe not, so... I don't know, because I don't think the draw is the kind of the bigger effects. I'm quite happy with my TV size. So I'm going to give it a 5 for small screen, I think.
Whoa, heavy. I'm going to give it a 4, because I'd like to have seen it on a big screen, but in 1999, I think if I watched it now on the big screen, there would be things that take me out of it too much. So yeah, if you can time travel and big screen, then yeah. But we can't do that, so it takes it down a point. Engagement score, Jake?
Oh, I think it's if you latch onto those performances and you vibe with them, then I think it's solid. But yeah, I'm actually absolutely fine with the Tialioni stuff, but I can see how people might not be. But I think it gets straight to your heart in the kind of last half an hour. There's so much stuff that can grab you. And so I'd give it a 4.
Michael?
I feel so bad for being the Tialioni attacker.
I was a catalyst behind that. So.
But I think if I can almost rank the engagement score for the three strands, I think 5 out of 5 for both, for both the suburban and the space strands, but probably a 3 or even maybe a 2. For Taya Leone, she's just not for me an engaging actress. So that probably.
But her dad is.
Her
really,
dad,
really?
Who's this Austrian German actor who hasn't really been in that much.
He kind of looks like Tony Erdmann.
Yeah.
I thought that.
He's brilliant.
And Vanessa Redgrave as well. She is good.
Yeah. Were we supposed to have a Tony Erdmann English version by now? I'm sorry, that's a massive sidetrack.
Yeah, it was going to be Jack Nicholson was going to come out of retirement to do it.
We're
saved there.
Helen?
It's a tricky one because it's not kind of like edge of your seat, fast-paced thriller. And at the same time, it's not unengaging either. So, yeah, I think I'm a solid 4. The thing is that it's surprising in that when the failures do happen or, kind of when... It's a bit like, actually, it is going to hit, and what we're going to see, that's it's different to like having to be gripped to the screen. So, yeah, a 4.
I'm glad you mentioned the failures, Helen, because that's something that I really love about the film. Like at all the other points in so many other films where it would be like the climax and the big finale or the last battle or something, once again, Morgan Freeman has to go up to the microphone and say, and that didn't work. Or Elijah Wood's plan about getting married and then get him on the bus, and that didn't work either. And it's just a film constantly about failure. It's fantastic.
Michael, what was your engagement score again?
So I think I had to average out 5, 5 and 2. So is that averages out as a 3?
Yep.
Or a 4? How does math work?
12 divided by 3 is 4.
4.
And your score, sorry, Helen?
4.
Let's go for 4. I think this is quite nice where you don't really have to pay attention all the time. This is kind of, you'd be on the sofa and when something kind of dies down a bit, Tia Leone comes screen, you can second screen it a bit and, you know, add to your Ricardo shop.
It's such a second screen film because you spend the whole time just trying to look people up on IMDb because everyone's so
What's
familiar.
Their name again?
Richard Sheer!
And I've just done a whole rewatch of West Wing and I couldn't remember his name. Richard Schiff is Elijah Wood's dad. Brilliant. And this, we have no real score of exactly 4.000000000. So.
So you've taken my no decimal points to heart there, everyone. You. I appreciate that.
Guys.
Solid 4.
Let's head to Twitter. And to get those guys, if you're listening to us for the first time or you've listened to us for a while and you haven't found us on Twitter, we are at FlixWatcherPod. And do follow us because we do put out a tweet asking for your thoughts and opinions before we go into reviewing. So look out for a tweet similar to we're reviewing Deep Impact with Jake Cunningham and Michael J. Leader from Ghibliotech. Have you seen it? Tell us your thoughts and the score out of 5 stars for an on-air shout-out on FlixWatcher. And we only had one response today. We had one response today, I should say, positively. Jake, as it was your choice.
Yeah, we got David Marples, who said he felt it was somewhat overshadowed by Armageddon. Unfairly too, this is superior. 4 Hobbits. Not quite sure about his rating system, but
it's four of them. Basically, he's just surmised what we said. Well, we've taken 40 minutes to say he's surmised in 128 characters. So well done, Dave Marples. Thank you. Thank you for, you should have done that earlier. We just had an awesome time. But thank you, Dave. That's awesome. Jake and Michael, tell us where we can find your book and your podcast, and we'll say goodbye to all the listeners.
Well, you can find the podcast on all good podcatchers, where we're Ghibliotech. That's Ghibliotoque. It's a tough spelling. But that's also the name of our book, which is going to be out in September, isn't it, Michael?
It is September the 2nd, wherever you order your books. It's kind of wild to see my name attached to a book being sold from Blackwells, having spent a lot of time in the Manchester branch of Blackwells growing up.
Are you from Manchester, Michael?
I am from Manchester. I grew up in Salford, Kobe. We've had this before. You accused me of not being Mancunian enough.
Yeah. It rings a bell. Yeah, Salford's not mine. But neither is where I'm from, but I still say Manchester. It's just a lot easier.
It's easier
Salford's,
for the...
Salford's its own city.
I know. If my dad had heard me saying that, he'd be writing in. But yes, you can find us on Twitter as well. Ghibliotech is at Ghibliotech, using the spelling that Jake just said. And I'm Michael J. Leader.
Thanks so much for coming on.
Cheers. Bye, guys. A pleasure.
Enjoyed this episode of FlixWatcher Podcast? Why not leave us a 5-star review on iTunes? You can also follow us at FlixWatcherPod on Twitter, and we're at FlixWatcher on Instagram. Thanks as always to the Mighty People for their mighty, mighty tunes, and Ben from Rockwood Audio for his awesome editing skills. If you're looking to get your podcast edited as sweet as this, get in touch with Ben, and that's Rockwood, R-O-K-K Wood Audio. Tell them FlixWatcher sent you.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.